Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. It's a special roundtable episode this week, looking at crime and the city. And we're focusing on our home city, London, because recent crime statistics back up what many Londoners have been feeling for months. They were living through a crime spike. While crime statistics can be cut numerous ways, and while we need to be aware of long-term trends, or whether more crimes are just being reported, the rates of knife and gun crime, burglaries and robberies are on the rise. And in London, there is an added danger. Crimes committed by scooter gangs. 23,000 such robberies took place in 2017. Urbanists and city watchers often talk about making safer, more inclusive cities. But is there really an urban solution? More security cameras and barriers? And even if the city felt more inclusive and well-designed, would a nice park really stop a crime wave? So join us over the next 30 minutes as we look at crime in the city and what can be done. That's coming up right here on The Urbanist.
There are no bobbies on our streets. Londoners, we don't feel safe.
Police in London are having to adopt new tactics to deal with an upsurge in moped crime.
It's certainly the crime of the moment, it appears in London.
Disfigurement and scarring, psychological torment, all are hallmarks of an acid attack.
Where's it hurting, mate? Your eyes?
Next thing, I'm burning, my seat's burning, my trainers are burning.
The epidemic, hundreds of knife crimes every week, driven, say the police, by territorial gangs, drugs.
I do look over my shoulder more than I used to.
We've had various stabbings. All of these victims are teenagers.
That if someone tried to pull up on me, I'll cut up my 15-inch stabbing.
Well, we need to have a relentless focus on preventing violent crime happening in the first place.
Because it's not easy living the life of a teenager in London if bad things can happen to you.
These things are symptoms of a system that is breaking.
So, welcome to our episode on crime and the city. We decided to do things slightly different this week and have asked four experts to unpack this complex topic. So, without further ado, let me introduce you to our panel. Here with me in London are Anna Mansfield, Rory Gagan, and Livy Haydock. And on the line is Richard Sennett. Anna Mansfield is the Director of Strategy and Research at the Urban Design and Public Realm Practice Publica. Rory Gagan is the Head of Criminal Justice at the Centre for Social Justice and used to be a police officer in the Metropolitan Police. Livy Haydock is an investigative journalist and filmmaker who was recently embedded with a gang here for her latest work, Inside Britain's Moped Crime Gangs. And Richard Sennett is the Head of Sociology at the London School of Economics, who has written extensively about urban disorder, among other topics. Well, Anna, perhaps a good place to start is there a problem out there? We've been talking about crime and urban crime. Is there something particular happening at this moment that you're beginning to hear about and see?
So in general terms, in recent decades, there's actually been a fall in overall levels of crime, and it's stabilising now, but that tends to hide some particularly low volume but serious crime, and crime which is impacting cities and really prevalent in London at the moment. So that would be knife crime, certain types of assaults and certain types of robberies. And I think we'll go on to talk about kind of moped theft and crime associated with that. And the spike in those crime figures is an urban one and very much in the public spaces in which we're living in London at the moment. So yes, things are happening, also allied to a growing awareness of the risk of terrorism. So those two things are really prevalent at the moment.
Now, Rory, you sit in a think tank. You're a former policeman. When we see these numbers, it always strikes me a bit like the information you get about diets. You can make it up and get anything you want out of the information. Some people say things are getting better. Some people say it's getting worse. You look at all these statistics, and for the average member of the public, it's very confusing to understand what's going on. First of all, sometimes people don't report crime. Sometimes there isn't suddenly a spike in reporting because of a trend. When you look at the statistics, what do you make of this moment we're in?
Yeah, so as as has been mentioned, you know, crime overall in the crime survey has fallen in recent decades. I think what's really interesting from the academic side of things that's coming out is studies that show that those reductions in crime haven't been enjoyed equally across society. So if you look at the sort of the poorest in society, their reductions in things like burglary, antisocial behaviour and so on, they haven't seen the same reduction that everyone else has. And so you're still left with the fact that the poorest are still most affected. And especially when you start looking at knife crime, gun crime, obviously the drug dealing and so on that often goes on with this, that does have a preponderance amongst some of the more vulnerable people within society. Vulnerable in the sense of, you know, being vulnerable to, for example, exploitation, whether it's through, you know, sort of criminal exploitation and being sort of part of a group in a city that then finds themselves actually sort of exported out into sort of less urban areas. So the whole phenomenon of county lines is this interesting sort of example of, you know, phenomenon from within a major urban city like London being kind of exported on a, you know, almost like a pipeline out into places like Brighton or Bournemouth or, you know, Plymouth and so on.
Livy, let's just quickly bring you in here, because anybody who watches your film, I think they will be alarmed. You know, we've seen in London the number of crimes carried out by people on scooters, all sorts of crimes, whether that's raiding shops, running into cafes and stealing people's laptops, but most prevalently the stealing of smartphones of people who are absentmindedly walking along the street. 23,000 crimes committed in 2017. The police are saying those numbers are going down now, but still huge numbers. You went out and you found these gangs, you went out with them, you interviewed them. When you spoke to them, were you alarmed at what was happening in London? Because during the arc of your film, no one gets arrested, no one gets caught, and they seem to be playing the police in an extraordinary way.
I think for me, I knew how bad it was. Everybody I know either knows someone who has been mugged or has seen one themselves. And so I wanted to try and find some logic in that chaos. So to do so, I think the better the devil you know, I wanted to go and meet the gangs and find out firstly how, as the Met have reported last year, that the moped has become the vehicle of choice for young offenders and how they're doing that. So not every kid's got a moped. So the majority, I think 38, are stolen a day in London last year. Now, if we think about it in terms of 50% of Londoners last year didn't lock up their bikes and so 38 a day are stolen, then maybe there's something that could be fixed there. But then also, so you take away the vehicle of choice, but then also you can look at how, and something we did in the film was investigate how they actually cash convert their stolen goods. So there are loopholes there that I think need to be closed. And I think these are issues that actually the general public could have really helped out, especially with the police shortages at the moment. There's a lot that, you know, everyone else could do to protect themselves.
Let's bring in Richard, who's on the line. Richard, as we say, we're seeing a crime spike here in London that seems undeniable. What should be the response of urban planners and city halls to what's going on? Should they be aligning with the police to bring in measures that change how our cities look? What's your feeling about how we address a spike such as this?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that we can, you know, we need to keep this in perspective and not be terrified by crime waves, which have existed off and on in cities, you know, since the beginning of cities. My worry is that out of fear of crime, we can do a lot of harm to the urban fabric. It can go from overlighting it so that the cities become kind of lunar landscapes, to super lockups of public places, treating the house as a fortress with four or five locks, you're afraid to go out, and so on. That's frankly not very sensible way to deal with the experience of crime. It's real, it has spikes and then, you know, changes its form over time. But you can do lasting damage by building a whole city around the notion that you want to prevent crime by designing how the city looks and operates. In my view, the most positive thing we can do is about many crimes is to get people out in the streets. A depopulated, empty street is a very inviting crime scene, whereas a place that's full of people is not so inviting.
Anna, let's just bring you back in here. You know, you're often brought in by people who are planning in nice parts of towns and in cities. You've been working in Bond Street, one of the key areas of central London. When people come to you, are they concerned about security measures? Because we've seen on the, and we don't want to make this the focus of the debate, but on the terror side, we've seen people actually take measures which are hidden, which are secretive, which don't actually change how you feel about the city, but they begin to change the landscape to make it more difficult for these crimes to happen. And even around the security of stores, it was interesting in the film, one of the robbers said, I wouldn't rob that store because they've got a double door entry system, it's too complicated. They were going for the more obvious targets. What part do you think that urban design can play in not solving crime, but in potentially putting off some of those actions?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I agree that these are societal issues and they're not really going to be solved with bollards and benches. So they're very visible in cities and we feel them most keenly there, but there are much bigger political issues at play here. That said, yes, clearly a lot of people will be very worried who run those types of businesses. It would not be appropriate or applicable to take really dramatic measures in all of the public space because the public space is the space we all share and it's not appropriate. And also crime and these kinds of things move very quickly and the built environment moves very slowly in terms of planning and construction. And you could never possibly keep up with those things. I understand keenly when quite quick measures have been taken around terrorist threat, and that's one thing. But we're actually talking about a very specific type of crime there. We do work across the whole of London. I think one of the things that came up earlier is this peak in crime at the moment, it's not affecting us all equally as citizens. I would be distinctly more worried if I was a teenager in this city. If I was a male teenager in this city, I would be more worried than I am walking down any of those streets. And I think where we spend a lot of time working neighbourhood plans, we meet families who don't let the children go out and play. We meet teenagers who won't go into their public spaces because of the prevalence of knives in those spaces. So I agree that if we start to change the public realm dramatically, that would be a huge problem. Having said that, we live in a city now where in the past 10 years, everything's been opening up a lot. We've been eating outside a lot more. The shop windows are floor to ceiling. We've seen the Apple store. We've seen things change dramatically in terms of how they're designed. It doesn't seem right that all the mitigation measures would be put in the public realm. More bollards and more benches. Those things should be probably within the building.
But you're not saying those. You're not saying we're to blame because we're eating outside or we're to blame because we've made fancy stores.
No, not at all. No, but it's a change in the way that we live, that we are on the streets. We do have incredibly expensive things in our hands. We're eating outside. We're enjoying a really different type of lifestyle. And at the same time, we've growing inequality and we need to think about those things. But should all of the measures to mitigate against those crimes also be put in the public realm? Probably not. It would get extremely busy. We've spent ages decluttering all of our streets to make them more attractive places for people to come for visitors. So I don't think filling them all up again is necessarily the answer. There must be other ways, and it's probably policing.
Rory, you're nodding in agreement?
Yeah, largely. I mean, it's really interesting when you look at kind of crime prevention and a lot of the language even that's used. So sort of target hardening is this sort of very unaesthetic term for sort of how we can make a potential crime target harder for the offender to sort of go after. To be honest, I don't think there's enough thought put in actually to kind of where target hardening might be appropriate. How do we balance that with what we're all talking about, which is that sort of broader quality of life? That's one piece. And I think the point earlier around police officers and that sort of, again, another sort of criminological term of, you know, the capable guardian. Who is the capable guardian of some of these spaces? As per the film, you know, we can clearly see that a lot of the public, understandably, don't view, and the offenders themselves don't view the police as being that capable guardian, whether it's the issue of resources, whether it's the issue of police officers not feeling they'll actually get the support they need if they take out the action that the public would like. And actually, I think in terms of a design perspective, I think what's interesting too is the bit about, well, where these young people are caught, because they are very prolific, and so eventually they do often get caught. What is the design? Well, how might we rethink the design of actually the criminal justice system, which, you know, is very much still about punitive peace and not enough actually about understanding the social factors?
Richard Sennett, Anna Mansfield, Roy Gagan and Livy Haydock, stay with us. We're going to take a short break. This is The Urbanist. Now, we've been discussing the increase in crime in London and what's led to this situation. But as the rates go up, has the public's concern about crime increased too? Well, Ben Page is the chief executive of Ipsos Mori, and he's the man with all the statistics.
What we're seeing in Britain, but in particular in London, is a rise in anxiety about crime, particularly in the first part of 2018. And in some months in London, anxiety about crime has now become the number one issue. So whereas nationally it's all about Brexit or the National Health Service, in London now, some months, crime is right up there with things like local issues like housing. And that just reflects some of the media coverage that we've seen recently. The drivers are in part real, in the sense that there have been more murders in London this year, and particularly there, of course, young people and knife crime. It's important to keep in perspective, of course, that actual levels of crime in London are still half those in New York in terms of the rate of murders. But nevertheless, for Britain, it is distressing, and it's the constant drip, drip, drip of violent signal crimes, which don't directly affect millions of people, but we hear about them, and it reminds us that the city isn't safe, particularly for young people. The public, of course, are reacting to things that are genuinely happening, and so I'm absolutely certain that Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, Chrisida Dick, who's head of the police in London, are absolutely concerned about the real numbers. And the concern, of course, is simply reflecting the change and velocity of the number of these crimes. So I think the public opinion is important. It's certainly not the be-all and end-all, but it's only reflecting what is actually starting to happen. And so the government and the police will react both to public opinion, but also, most importantly, to the actual rise in violent crime.
That was the chief executive of Ipsos Mori, Ben Page. Welcome back to The Urbanist, and still with me are Livy Haydock, Richard Sennett, Rory Gagan, and Anna Mansfield.
Livy, you know, we talk about social cohesion and not having isolated communities. But when you met these young men, did you think there was an opportunity? At the end of the film, you attempt to show that actually even one of the worst criminals, you know, he has hopes and dreams that could be taken away from crime. But did you think that as a city, there was something London could do to engage with these young men? Or is the gang situation with these men so powerful that there's very little that can be done?
No, I think there are two things going on here. So I think that firstly, and especially with the young gang member I took to the Formula One, we gave him an opportunity, basically, because he had talent. But I think, how can these kids be what they can't see? So they have absolutely nothing to look at except their peers. So if you see someone and you're broke as anything, your mum's broke, you're living a life you don't want to be living, the only opportunities you see are quick earning. Well, in this case, moped crime. But then on the other side of that, I think that these kids are scared of each other. I think a lot of the rise in violent crime, especially with the weapons, it's a vicious circle in that, I mean, if you take February, for example, within 1 week, they'd seized 250 weapons, knives and swords. And I think they arrested 283 people, mostly, you know, teenagers. And I really think that a lot of this reporting as well is kind of adding to that. And they're scared of each other. So if you know that next man's got a knife, you're going to get one too.
Richard, we talk about, you know, an inclusive urbanism. We talk about stopping parts of our cities feeling isolated. You know, it's a conversation you can hear at any urbanist conference. But is that enough to help these kinds of people who are caught in criminality, in neighbourhoods which are caught up in gang crime? Is there anything there that, you know, an urbanist can go in and do and suggest to kind of change those areas to make them less riddled with crime?
Well, I'm a little disturbed that you would equate poverty or deprivation as such with crime. There are lots of very poor people who are very law-abiding. And if you begin blaming the neighborhood or the social conditions for the fact that people commit crimes, you're doing, I think, most people who are poor an injustice. That said, I mean, what really helps in, at least in the American poor communities that I know, where people are at risk of becoming criminals to a greater degree than they are elsewhere, is lots of intermediate institutions which are visible in the community. That is, for instance, mobilizing churches, voluntary organizations, after school groups and the like, to work with kids. As was just said, the worst thing that you can do with adolescents is leave them isolated to themselves in general. And that's particularly true of kids who are at risk of committing crimes. It's worked in the U.S., where we don't have, in New York, for instance, we have, you know, lower stabbing rates than we have in London among juvenile population. The reason for that is there are lots of visible adults who are interacting with vulnerable kids. Here we tend to leave things too much, I think, to the state. And if the Church of England were a more robust institution communally, it could play that role. And I think we have to find, since it isn't, other forms of non-governmental voluntary organizations which are present to these young people, giving them different kinds of models.
Rory, Rich is there saying that we shouldn't think about isolated communities being more vulnerable to producing street criminals. I'm not sure if that's correct. I don't see many middle-class scooter gangs going around. And whether that doesn't mean that there's more criminality in one community or another, it means what you have access to. And actually, in the film, lots of the young guys talked about wealth. They talked about their exclusion from wealth and the need to find money. There was a question of poverty that definitely came up there. And you do a huge amount of work with making sure that we don't target communities as being poor is good or rich is good or poor is bad, whatever. What's your view on what we need to do about social inclusion and whether that does have an impact on criminality?
I think it absolutely does. And I think when we talk about sort of crime disproportionately impacting on the poorest, that's both in terms of obviously victimisation rates often, but it is also in actually the disproportionality, if you will, or the disparity in the offending too, actually, in some of these cases, which isn't to say that obviously everyone in a particular community, whether poor or rich, is therefore all of them committing more crime or committing crime at all. It's just that when you look at the particular sort of vulnerabilities, so if you have a young man who perhaps has a bit of a learning disability or difficulty, has maybe a single parent, and that parent themselves is struggling with perhaps an addiction or debt or some other issue, or perhaps there are two adults in the house and there's domestic violence. All of those sorts of issues do contribute to that young person themselves feeling, as we know from surveys in London, 8% of young people in London feel least safe at home. I mean, that is truly terrifying. And of course, if you're feeling least safe at home, well, where do you look to find safety? And it's not at home, obviously, so therefore it's out on the streets. And then who is out on the streets, coming back to this issue of those people who are out and about looking out for people? Sometimes it's people who've not got the best intentions. It's people who are looking for someone to help sling drugs. It's looking for people looking to find younger vulnerable girls and to traffic them into sexual exploitation. So I do think there is this key issue, and linked to it also is the response of the education system, where those same sort of issues at home have an impact on kids' behaviour in the classroom. And so, how the schools manage that, often they exclude, and in excluding out of a school, in they go to a pupil referral unit, and from there, as is well sort of documented, it becomes a bit of a pipeline to prison. So there is something very much, and you go out, go to South London or any part of London actually, and you will find these community centres that really do a great job of offering that inclusion. And it's something quite at odds with what the state does. The state's interventions are often very sort of time-bound, rather than the voluntary sector, which is very much sort of vocational, mission-driven.
Richard, bring you back in here. We said earlier on that if you have moments where people feel that their city is changing in ways that they feel that they can't control and they can't impact on, none of us is going to be able to stop a scooter gang. None of us is going to be able to stand up to somebody with potentially a machete. That then do you begin to make those options, or is this really the neighbourhood for me? Should I be living back out in the suburbs? And that's exactly what happened in the 60s and 70s, is what we don't want to happen now. The sense of a city segregating into areas which feel safer and not safer. We want this mix. But is it enough to hope that by creating better public realm, creating better places for us to come together in town squares, in Agora, that we can do something that changes our perception and lets us all hold together in that moment?
Well, you said something that, if I may say so, I think is not factually quite right. White flight is something that often precedes rather than comes from crime. This was true of Harlem in New York, and it's true of parts of London, that areas are abandoned by people with more resources, not because they're under physical threat, but for different kinds of economic reasons, some of which are purely racial, and some have to do with social mobility. Whatever those reasons are, that flight can precipitate a more risky environment. And the reason this matters is that the issue is how to get people who are stable, who have relatively enough resources, whose children have a different kind of educational ethos, to stay in a community. If you dwell on how violent, potentially violent, mixed places are, you can start spiking white flight. And that the consequences of white flight is that you'll then realize spikes in crime. So I'm just, if I may say so, I think you've got it backwards. The question is how we keep the city mixed rather than if it's mixed, you know, will this be enough to deal with criminal issues?
We only have a few minutes left, so a concluding thought from everybody and maybe a nudge from me. But Livy, you've met these young men who are involved in these scooter gangs. What would be your feeling about what we should do as citizens and as a city to both engage with them, but also to think about the wider problems of their situations? You know, as you said in the film, many of these people come from difficult backgrounds. They didn't seem to have large networks of friends beyond their other co-conspirators. What were your thoughts about what we could do beyond kind of locking up our bicycles and being a little bit more aware?
I think definitely being more aware is a major factor, but I think that this kind of us and them mentality really needs to be rethought. I think it exists too strongly, creates this divide within communities. And actually, with the rise in violent crime, a lot of that violent crime that I've ever come across, about 9 out of 10 cases I come across, drugs are at the heart of it. So we've got to ask why this market that these people are fighting between themselves and it's spilling out onto the street, why that market exists. And that's not something from the estates. That's, you know, universal. We have a lot of users in England, you know.
And Rory, we've had some very good points over the last half hour, from holding our nerve to small steps that we can do, as Livy suggests. But what would be your kind of argument about how we should go forward to ensure that we do feel safe in the city and that we don't overreact, but that we do put measures in place that could potentially help the city?
I think you just need to look at New York as one example of a city that managed a huge turnaround. More locally, more sort of closer to home, you can look at Glasgow and what was done there to sort of really drive down the serious violence that was going on there, with gangs. And I think really the social contract sits at the heart of this. You know, we have an obligation to each other, but the state also has an obligation to us, as we have to it, to actually create safe spaces for people. And I don't think we're seeing that yet. I think, you know, government and the mayor need to get a grip. You know, when I recently spoke with some young men who've started to turn their lives around and get onto a positive trajectory, and I asked them what hopes and dreams they had for their children, they said they hoped to bring them up outside London. And I think that itself is telling and, in you know, damning, and we need to get this back on track.
Anna, you're a practitioner who makes a difference to how our city looks and feels every day. For our listeners, what would be your words of wisdom that you think that we should focus on?
I think we should celebrate the great changes that have been happening to our city, but we do need to make sure that the benefits of those changes extend to everyone. It's echoing what we've said, but I do think that we need to make sure that we fund the social services at the heart of our city that make sure that we're not accidentally contributing to the conditions that can make crimes like these thrive.
And Richard, a concluding thought from yourself.
Well, I don't think we can build our way out of dealing with crime. Like your other panelists, I think this is a social problem that needs social resources to deal with it, from police to better schools to intermediate organizations. I think that's a more positive way to deal with the issues of isolation and kind of in-group aggression that are leading to crime spike now. In other words, I don't think there's something wrong with the way London is built, but I do think there are things that need to be changed in the resources that people have to live in it.
Thank you very much to our panel today, Richard Sennett, Rory Gagan, Livy Haydock and Anna Mansfield.
Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and it was researched by Paige Reynolds and edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Neil Young with Crime in the City. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
They paint my car like a target. I take my...